Okay, welcome to the situation update for March 1st, 2022. Mike Adams here, the Health Ranger. Thank you for joining me today. I've got a lot of updates, but the overall emphasis of today's podcast is about how to survive cyber war or nuclear war. And of course, I'm the author of a free downloadable ebook or audiobook plus a PDF transcript called Survival Nutrition. And people love that book. It's absolutely free. You can get it. I recommend it, obviously, survivalnutrition.com. You just register with your email, subscribes you to the Natural News free email newsletter. You can unsubscribe at any time, of course, and you can download the entire book. You can listen to it. Now, a lot of listeners to this podcast have already listened to Survival Nutrition. I might suggest it could be worthwhile to go back and listen to it again in light of where we are now with Russia and possible escalation into a nuclear war and cyber warfare. So there are a lot of tidbits that may only really become obvious in the context of what we're all living through right now. So give it a second listen, or at least check out the transcript if that's something that you think might benefit you. But we are going to go through today some practical things, a lot of practical things that people can do to stay safe no matter how the escalation happens. Now, one of the first things we need to understand is that this conflict is being escalated. It's being escalated by Biden, I think, on purpose, Biden's handlers. And I think Putin is also playing a role in this escalation. Obviously, it takes two superpowers to escalate this. And it seems to me that the powers that be that, you know, rigged our election and really hate America, that they want to use this escalation to harm America, to bring down America's infrastructure, banking systems, power grid, telecommunications systems, and so on. And so I think this is the opportunity they've been waiting for or even creating in order to achieve that. So if you ask me, which is more likely, nuclear war or cyber attacks, I think cyber warfare is more likely to impact you than nuclear. It doesn't mean there won't be nuclear war. It's just that cyber warfare, it's much easier for nation states to pull off. It's even easier for the deep state to pull off because it's very difficult for anybody to know who's responsible. You know, they can scapegoat somebody else. They can do it themselves and blame Putin or blame some hacker group or blame, I don't know, Trump supporters or what have you. So I think that the risk of cyber attacks is actually higher than the risk of nuclear warfare at this moment. That's subject to change based on, you know, what happens next, and things can change pretty quickly. But that's where we are right now. So what happens in a cyber warfare attack that affects us directly? Why does that accentuate the need for preparedness and survival? Well, think about all the things that run on systems that are connected to the internet. And if you go back to the 1980s, almost nothing ran connected to the internet because there was not really an internet. So yeah, you still had SWIFT for international banking transactions, but your local bank didn't have a website where you logged in and did business online. Instead, you walked into the bank. And those of you who are as old as I am, you can remember having a little savings account book, a little booklet, like a passport type of thing. And you walk into the bank, you know, with $5 in your pocket because it was the 1970s or 1980s, and you give them $5 and they put it in your account, and they take your book and they run it through a little bank printer, and it prints a new line on there that adds $5 to your balance. So you could always look at the book, and that's how you knew how much money you had. Now, for younger people hearing this, you're probably aghast. Like, what? You looked at it on paper? Yes, that's how it all worked. And in fact, that was more secure than having online systems that people could hack into all the time and loot your account and guess your password or engage in social engineering. You know, people actually had to go in and impersonate you and maybe even steal your little book in order to loot money out of your account. Banking was more secure in the 1980s than it is today. And the same thing is true for the power grid. Back then, the power grid was all offline. Nothing was connected to the cloud. And frankly, the systems that ran the power grid back then were mostly hardware systems based on physics. They didn't have embedded software code with bugs in it. You know, they didn't need to have software updates for, you know, coal power plants version 6.7. And then it turns out, oh, it crashed the coal power plant, you know, and then you have to reboot the power plant. It's just like running Windows, basically. So these days, everything has to have updates. Even like your TV, you know, you go out and buy a screen, a display, and it's got, you know, Roku built into it. And it's got all these other systems, Amazon Prime or Netflix built into it. And the software is all buggy, and the software has got to be updated. Well, we didn't have that, obviously, back in the 1980s and 70s. You had VCRs with tape, with a big plastic cassette cartridge, and you plugged it in, and it played the tape. And when you finished watching the movie, you had to rewind the tape. And if you didn't rewind, the video rental places would charge you an extra 50 cents. Remember that? You ever get a penalty for not rewinding? I did. It's like an overdue library book, but the VCR version, you know. So the point is that systems were more secure, actually, back before everything became interconnected. And what that means is that the interconnectedness that now exists makes these systems far more vulnerable. So we are right now, by definition, living in the time that is most vulnerable to cyber attacks than any other previous time throughout human history. It is the worst vulnerability right now. And I know companies and the power grid operators and governments and so on, and I know they say, oh, we've hired, you know, security personnel and we've had, you know, all these systems that have passwords and everything. And then you find out that a lot of these big systems that oversee everything are themselves compromised. And what was that one system called? Was it SolarWinds, I think, that got heavily hacked? And SolarWinds was running all kinds of systems. This came out right around the election, you know, 2020 election. And I think it was SolarWinds. I forgot the exact name. But many corporations were running that software. And I think, in fact, it was one of the pipelines along the East Coast that got hacked and ended up in a cyber warfare, what is it, ransomware? You know, pay us this much money in Bitcoin and we'll turn your system back on. I think that was a SolarWinds vulnerability, if I'm remembering correctly. But anyway, even if that's not exactly correct, because I'm just going from memory, that kind of thing is happening with these embedded systems all around the world. These overview software packages, the systems that are supposed to make your life easier, they are actually, in many cases, the ones that are more vulnerable to cyber warfare. So what's actually been happening over the last several years is that China and Russia and North Korea and other independent hacker groups have been pinging and probing and figuring out where the vulnerabilities are to all of these systems that run the power grid and run the hospitals and run governments and corporations and telecommunications systems and, of course, banks, including the central bank. And by doing this, they've been able to identify vulnerabilities. And when you have government-run hacker groups, like cyber warfare groups, which is what China runs and North Korea and Russia and the United States, by the way, what they'll do often is they will find and document vulnerabilities, but not exploit them at that time. They would instead add them to a known list of documented exploits or vulnerabilities that could be targeted later on in a coordinated cyber attack. And so if Russia, let's say, or China or anybody, if they were going to unleash a cyber attack against America, they would very likely do it in a coordinated fashion that would take advantage of multiple exploits that are known and documented across many different types of infrastructure. So that tells you something very important, that in preparing for cyber warfare, we have to be ready for not just one system to be attacked, such as financial institutions. We have to be ready for a simultaneous attack on multiple systems. because that's the most likely way that this kind of cyber warfare attack is going to go down. They're going to hit everything at once. They're going to hit government. They're going to hit, you know, fuel refineries, fossil fuels. They're going to hit the power grid. They're going to hit everything all at once. And that means if they are successful, and they won't have a 100% success rate, of course. The success will vary. There could be regional blackouts, but not nationwide blackouts. Some systems could go down for a matter of hours, but then people on site might be able to override the exploit, maybe restore a previous OS or who knows what. You know, reboot the system, kick the servers, whatever it takes, and get it back online. That could take hours, it could take days, it could take weeks, or in some cases it could be months. So the thing about cyber warfare is that the outages are going to be very unpredictable, and they can occur for durations that are impossible to know in advance. So you may have a loss of banking systems for your bank for weeks, but another bank might be functional. Or the power grid in your town may be down, but a power grid, you know, a couple states away may function. Or you might have, you know, maybe food stamps work in your city, but they don't work in other cities. That's what this is going to look like. And so it means you got to be able to adapt and maneuver very quickly in order to respond to the outages and the problems and what the public is doing with those outages. And that's the other factor here that deserves a lot of mention. It's not just how you prepare to have, you know, a failed power grid, or how you prepare for grocery stores to be unable to process credit card transactions, for example. It's about, and I think this is even really the bigger issue, it's about how the public responds when those capabilities and functions are no longer working. You know, the public, generally speaking, the public has, you know, some buffer built in, some amount of understanding where, you know, if a grocery store says, well, we can't process any transactions right now, cash only, or maybe they even say, we can't even open the cash registers because we forgot how, you know, it's been so long since we counted pennies and coins, but it could get ugly. It's like, okay, here's how you count change. Let me teach you this. We learned it in the first grade, but nobody knows how to do that anymore for some reason. It's amazing. But the public that's walking around with shopping carts full of food in the grocery store, they might be willing to wait around 15, 20, 30 minutes, maybe even an hour, but you start getting beyond hours and the natives get restless, you know, or if there's no gas for days, people start freaking out, or no food for days. So one of the big questions in all of this is, how does the public react, and what does that mean for you and, you know, your preparedness? It's a huge and very real question. So we're going to get to some of the practical things that this entails. First, I want to bring in, I think it's March 1st. And so that means we have a new sponsor that I would like to introduce at some length here. I think you're going to find them very interesting. And it is about a personal health transformation. And the company is called Energized Health. And that's their website, energizedhealth.com. And some of you may recall I did an interview with the founder, John Jubilee, and his wife, Chelsea. They both run Energized Health. You can see my interview with them. It was a couple of weeks ago. It's up on my channel on brighteon.com. And they've developed a really interesting system for enhancing cellular hydration in a way that people rave about. Their existing customers and clients rave about how it gives people, you know, better recovery from exercise. It helps them balance their body weight better, enhance cognitive function, the muscle aches and joint aches and pains and things like that tend to go away when you have better hydration. You know, everything functions better. And John Jubilee, I came to find out, has a patent pending system. I haven't read the patent. That would be interesting. For how to achieve this cellular hydration. And he says, not just about drinking water, because you can drink water all day long. It just goes through you. You end up peeing a lot, which is not necessarily a good way to spend the day. But this is about how to get water into the cells so that the cells are plump, like full of water, and then doing their job appropriately instead of shriveled up, you know, like raisins, like dry, dusty cells or something. You know, that sounds bad. Yeah. And think about blood flow. How does your blood flow if you're dehydrated? Well, it doesn't that well, right? So hydration of your blood is key. hydration of your joints, hydration of your spine. And, you know, the spinal, the cushions, the little cushion pads between your vertebrae, I forgot what those are called exactly, but they need water too. So anyway, this program, EnergizeHealth.com, it's a program, it's a lifestyle choice, it's a coaching system, and I think it's about 100 days, and you get a coach assigned to you, and you get to join their group Zoom calls once a week, you get videos every day. It's like it's a course, and you get all this support and everything. It's a real commitment. And wanted to let you know, I have signed up for it myself. And I think I'm beginning maybe tomorrow or the next day with a personal coach that's supposed to be calling me. So I'm doing the 100-day challenge with Energize Health because, well, I would like faster recovery with less pain after I train in jujitsu. Like, I really love doing jujitsu and martial arts, and I hurt after spending hours doing, like, arm bars and chokeouts and all kind of wrestling maneuvers and takedowns and getting slammed to the mat on my back, you know, things like that. I hurt after that, and John was explaining to me how better hydration is going to let me recover more quickly and give me more strength so that I can be more effective in what I'm doing. And so I said, sign me up, man. So he did. So he signed me up. I'm on that for 100 days. So I'm on the 100-day challenge. Now, so then after that, they decided to become a sponsor here of Brighteon and our podcast. So I want to thank them for the sponsorship and thank you for, you know, taking the time to listen to who they are, EnergizeHealth.com. But I also want to put a challenge out to John Jubilee, the founder of Energize Health. And say publicly, you know, I'm taking your health challenge for 100 days. I'm going to give you, John, a challenge. Listen to my podcast for 100 days, and we'll see which one of us lasts longer, because I'm going to hit you with some crazy comedy and satire and mind-blowing analysis here on the podcast. And frankly, not everybody can handle the podcast for 100 days. So I'm going to check in with you, John, and see how you're doing like 30 days in. Are you still... You still able to handle the podcast? And my goal is to stay on his program longer than he stays on my podcast. And that's our challenge. We'll see who can actually hold out for 100 days, and maybe we'll both emerge as more informed and healthier people on the other side of that. I hope so. At least that's the challenge. It's a fun challenge in a positive spirit. But if you want to learn about what they do, energizehealth.com is the website. And that's our sponsor for today. So thank you for checking them out and thank them for the support. So we're going to get into a lot of the practical steps that we can do to insulate ourselves from cyber warfare and the fallout from that. Couple of interesting programming notes. I interviewed Del Bigtree yesterday in the new Brighteon studio. And the Brighteon studio is open for, in-person interviews. I'm going to be inviting a doctor to come in who's an expert in chlorine dioxide. In fact, he listens to his podcast. So yeah, I'm talking to you, Dr. G. Inviting you to get into the studio now, do an interview about chlorine dioxide and, COVID and, freedom from vaccines, all kinds of things like that. I also had the Patriot Street Fighter, Scott McKay, in studio in the new Brighteon studio, which has just opened up now. I mean, it's like the inaugural series of interviews, and those are going to be airing later this week on my channel. On Brighteon.com. And then, Scott McKay, Del Bigtree, and myself, we did a three-person kind of a round table thing about alternative media. And this is for an upcoming event that Scott McKay was helping to organize. I don't recall the name of the event, actually, but I'll find that out for you and share that with you. It's an online event coming up in a few weeks. And I think we had a fascinating discussion, the three of us, and, I got to learn a few new things about Del Bigtree, and he's looking great and doing great. We're happy to get to see him again as well. All right, with that said, it's going to be an interesting week. It's going to be an interesting year. So let's start with some strategies of insulating yourself from cyber attacks. One of the most important things is to do a personal audit of your dependence on the cloud. So what are the things that you do in your life, day-to-day life, or your specific needs? And a lot of these can include financial needs, but also some people have, you know, smart homes, which I'm completely opposed to. but they have smart homes and the home doesn't work and the locks don't work and the refrigerator doesn't work and all these things are broken if the cloud goes down. And a lot of people experienced that recently with the cratering of the Amazon AWS system from time to time. And, you know, people who own Tesla vehicles, they've had times when the Tesla servers aren't working and then they were unable to use their vehicles because they were locked down or something. I don't own a Tesla, so I don't know exactly what happened, but it's a good time to audit your life and think about all your dependencies on the cloud because those things will not function. And this can include crypto, by the way. And you know, I'm pro crypto. I'm pro DeFi, you know, decentralized finance, and I support alternatives to the corrupt criminal banking systems for sure. However, there's a very good reason why I think you should think twice if you have all your eggs in the crypto basket and you don't have any physical gold and silver, then what are you going to do when the grid goes down? And that's why I believe the best backup plan for these kinds of scenarios is to, you know, spread your risk around. And that might mean some amount of crypto that's in a portable wallet where you can carry it with you on an encrypted thumb drive or something, let's say. Or perhaps an online wallet, although I'm mostly against that because usually that means you don't control the keys. So I prefer physical, you know, thumb drives with digital wallets where you control the keys and they're in your possession and you can make a backup of them and you can have that backup stored somewhere safely, but then you can be mobile with your crypto wallet in your pocket, let's say, or hidden in your shoe or wherever. But in addition to that, I believe you need to have physical gold and silver. You need to have physical ammunition as a barter item. You need to have physical goods that you can trade with as a form of currency, which could include, you know, food or salt or all kinds of things, emergency medicine, isopropyl alcohol, iodine. That's going to be real popular with Russia talking about nuclear war. In fact, I think iodine sales right now in our store have spiked up because of that. We still do have inventory. That's good news. So not everybody's made that link yet, I suppose, but it's coming. In any case, think about where all your dependencies are. Now, when it comes to money, just realize whether the power grid goes down or the banks go down, either way, you can't access the banks. So banks are vulnerable from multiple vectors. And this is why I don't trust having, you know, fiat currency money in a banking system run or influenced by a corrupt government. And I think Canada just proved that point when they started looting people's bank accounts because people donated money through Give, Send, Go to the convoy truckers. You know, you donate 20 bucks and then the government steals 20,000 out of your bank account if you have that much. It's absurd. So this is why people are now actively seeking alternatives. And I know that a lot of the alternatives are crypto. Crypto needs a power grid. But again, that's why you spread the risk around with other physical goods as well. Okay, think about transportation now. You know that gas stations, they need electricity in order to pump the gas. So you're probably not going to be able to get fuel in the middle of a power grid failure or even a banking transaction failure system. You won't be able to use credit cards at the gas station. And it's questionable whether they're going to be able to accept cash or even run the pumps. But it's good to have some backup green cash, believe it or not. Some fiat cash is good for this reason and other reasons because local people recognize cash as an instant form of money, right? So even if the power grid's down, people still recognize $100 bills and there's going to be, quote, faith or trust in the fiat currency for a while. And that's why I encourage people, if you've got enough money, you know, think about having a few thousand dollars worth of bills sitting around, you know, in a safe place, obviously, because that might be something that people recognize. You might be able to buy gas with that or food with that. Whereas silver as money, it's going to take a little longer for that reality to seep in. I mean, a lot of people know what silver is, but a lot of people don't. And right now, if you go to the grocery store and try to buy groceries with silver, they're going to look at you like, we don't take silver. Do you have credit cards? So when the credit cards go down and the debit cards go down and the food stamps go down and the cash registers don't work and all that, silver will eventually become a more commonly circulated form of money, but it will take time. So think about fiat currency as your immediate form of money that people recognize, and then silver as more of a medium-term form. And that could include so-called constitutional silver, which is the junk silver, pre-1963 coins, quarters, for the most part, that have a very high silver content. I think they have about 91% silver. You know, that's back when the coinage actually was physically worth something. It wasn't just zinc. junk silver quarters are instantly recognizable, and they will become, I think, very common forms of currency in a collapse. All right. In addition to that, let me talk about fuel again for a second. It's a great idea to have backup fuel. And I've mentioned this before, but it's worth bringing back up. There's a reason why I tend to drive diesel vehicles. And I think a diesel truck is ideal. One of the reasons is that it is much safer to store diesel compared to gasoline. And diesel lasts a lot longer than gasoline. You can store diesel for technically a decade if you put in the right antibacterial additive into it. Whereas gasoline can be bad in 2 years. So diesel's longer term. Diesel is much safer because it has a much higher flash point or combustion point, as it's called. So gasoline will combust at a much lower temperature than diesel, which means diesel is safer to carry around, safer to handle. And I don't recommend doing this yourself, but I've done these experiments because I'm curious. You can take diesel, or I could take diesel and pour it into a container, like a bucket. And again, I don't recommend you do this, but if you were to throw a match at the bucket of diesel, in my experience, that will not ignite the diesel. I've tried this, okay, so I know it does not ignite. Why is that? If you were crazy enough to throw a match at a bucket of gasoline, it would be a big explosion that would obviously be very dangerous. But diesel in a bucket in liquid form, at least at the temperatures that I've tested, it does not spontaneously combust. This is why diesel engines have to, in fact, compress diesel vapor at very high pressures and temperatures in order to get it to combust. That's why diesel engines are very different from gasoline engines. And that's why diesel vehicles, when they're involved in wrecks, they don't just burst into flame, not nearly as easily as gasoline vehicles. So think about this when you're driving around too. It's safer to drive a diesel vehicle, technically. But the thing is, when people store gasoline, they tend to store it indoors. And gasoline vapors can rise up out of the storage containers, and in an enclosed space with very little ventilation, what you're actually creating, if you have a leak in your gas can, you're creating what's called a fuel air explosive, or FAE. Yeah, fuel air bomb, or fuel air explosive. And those are weapons used by the military, and it can blow up your house, you know? So I don't like to store gasoline, and I don't, but I do store diesel because it's much safer. So think about how much diesel would you need, if you have a diesel vehicle, to get to your bug out location. And obviously, hopefully your bug out location does not require the power grid to function. You know, maybe you have a solar panel and a 12 volt battery and a charge controller, or maybe you have an emergency solar generator, and you can charge simple devices, phones and laptops, and satellite phones, or GPS devices, you know, things like that, flashlights, things that can help get you by. You're going to need all that off-grid tech at your bug-out location, but in order to get there, you need to have enough fuel to get there. So calculate what you need and then double it, because you might be on a road that's crowded. You might have to idle for a while, and you might have desperate people that you want to give fuel to, or you might have looters or insurgents or whoever that's trying to steal the diesel from you. So it's always good to have extra fuel, you know, just in case. Now, let's talk about off-grid cooking. The single most important thing is to be able to boil water. And you can boil water by using rocket stoves, and you can make a rocket stove yourself out of cinder blocks. And they're standard cinder blocks that are 16 inches by 8 inches by 8 inches. And they have like two large square holes in them. And they're, you know, cinder blocks are used to make walls for buildings and so on. You can go to any hardware store and you can buy cinder blocks. Well, if you go on YouTube and you search for cinder block rocket stove, you can find lots of videos of how to just arrange the cinder blocks. I mean, just stacking them in a certain arrangement so that the holes line up in a certain way, you can make a rocket stove. And then on the top of the top cinder block, you just put like a metal grill and then you can boil water. Or you can go buy rocket stoves or you can buy outdoor stoves or whatever. You can use a campfire and a suspended metal pot on a tripod, you know, old Western style. But the most important thing is to be able to boil water. Once you can boil water, you can do all kinds of things. You can sanitize, you know, surgical tools, for example, or washcloths or rags or things like that. But of course, you can also then boil water to make meals. And, you know, you can fry eggs, right? You've got a cooking surface. And that is critical for your long-term survival, especially in colder climates. You need to be able to boil water. So whatever your plans are for, you know, bugging out or surviving, make sure you've got multiple redundant ways to heat and boil water so that you can cook meals and make soup and sanitize things using hot water. I think that's absolutely critical for this time that we're going into. Now, in addition to that, remember, this is all being done in the context of auditing what are your dependencies on the grid right now. What are your dependencies on banks? What are your dependencies on telecommunications? And one of the most common dependencies that people often don't think about is the ability to call 911 and to get firefighters to come out if you have a fire, or to get police to come out and solve your problem by bringing men with guns, typically. Sometimes women with guns. Sometimes men and women with guns, and sometimes they know how to use those guns, but not always, as we've seen from various online videos. So, in a cyber attack scenario, just figure 911 goes down. You don't have 911. So how do you take charge of being your own, let's say, quote, firefighter? And I'm not saying run into burning buildings because that's insane, but I am saying have fire extinguishers. I can't tell you how many people have smoke alarms and no fire extinguishers. It's like, okay, you got the alarm part down, great, but what do you have to put out the fire? And most people, their response is, well, I'm just going to call 911 and then they're going to come put out the fire. I'm like, what if you could put out the fire yourself? What if you just have a pan on fire in your kitchen? You just going to call 911 and abandon your home and just wait for it to burn and wait 12 minutes for the fire department to show up? Or wouldn't it be awesome if after the smoke alarm goes off, you had a fire extinguisher in the kitchen and you just grab that, you pull the pin out, you point the nozzle at the base of the flames, people, the base of the flames, not the flames themselves. Every firefighter knows this. And then you squeeze the handle and it goes and it sprays, you know, whatever material you have all over the base of your fire. Your fire's out. Turns out you don't even need to call the fire department in a lot of cases of small indoor fires. So, but a lot of people don't think about this and they don't have fire extinguishers. Now, I'm kind of a fire extinguisher geek. And then again, I do weird experiments like throwing matches at buckets full of diesel just to see what would happen. So I do play with fire. And I teach how to make emergency fire starting devices. And I film those videos indoors and I light fires of those small devices indoors. But you'll notice in those videos, I always have a fire extinguisher. Because a lot of people don't realize what can be fuel in a fire. A lot of things can be fuel. Your clothing, even like plastics can catch on fire. Wood, cardboard boxes, paper. You know, half the things in your home, including the home itself, the lumber, the 2x4s, it's all fuel for fires. So fires can rage indoors, obviously. I mean, we've all seen that houses can burn down, but a lot of people could have stopped those fires. So that's number one. Don't count on being able to call 911 to put out fires. Invest in some good fire extinguishers. It's one of the best investments, frankly, I think you can ever make. And by the way, Everybody has a built-in smoke detector. It's called your nose. If you can't smell smoke, I know some people's sense of smell was damaged by COVID or protein, spike protein shedding. I get that. But in normal situations, people can smell smoke. So if you smell smoke, you should immediately know where to find the fire extinguisher, how to use it, and whether it's too big for you or not. Maybe you need multiple fire extinguishers. Maybe you need all your family members trained in how to use one. You can put out some pretty big fires, it turns out, with like two or three fire extinguishers. And they're not cheap. I just bought two more. I think I paid $60 each because they're kind of high-end fire extinguishers, because I'm a bit of a fire extinguisher snob. I admit it. I think that's one of the best investments you can make, frankly. It's dirt cheap compared to everything burning down, okay? Now, think about the same thing for police. So 911's not working. You got a problem at your home. You got stalkers outside. You got zombies walking through your lawn looking for food. Whatever's going on. You got, looters, carjackers. Well, calling 911 obviously doesn't work when there's no telecom system. So you got to be your own 911. What does that mean? Self-defense, firearms training, learning how to use weapons in self-defense and also then carrying them. So getting a concealed carry permit if it's required in your state, or maybe open carrying if that's something that you choose to do and it's legal to do in your area. But don't be caught without a means of self-defense, especially when 911 is not working, because that emboldens the criminals. They're like, hey, 911's down. They're like, great, let's go out and just loot, That's when you should be on high alert. Now let's talk about shelter, which means, how do you live in your home when today's homes are not designed to function without electricity? So today's homes are built as kind of, tombs if they're off grid. There's no air exchange with the outside. That's how they achieve that green rating, is to have no air exchange. Truly, it's crazy. But think about homes that were built in the 1960s or 70s, especially in southern places. Think about Arizona or Texas or, New Mexico, whatever, Southern California. The homes had air movement. They were designed to let air move through the homes because you didn't have air conditioning in most cases back then. But you could actually live in a home, especially in a drier climate like southern Arizona, with adobe construction and so on. You could live in those homes even at very hot temperatures because the home, number one, it had a lot of mass because of the adobe construction and a lot of air moving through. And you could sweat and control your body temperature, through evaporation of your own sweat and so on. So it was livable without air conditioning. Today, in the same cities, and look at Phoenix or Tucson, in the same cities, the homes there are not livable without air conditioning. If you have no power grid in Phoenix in the middle of the summer, that home becomes a tomb. You have to get out. So most people, it turns out, are not living in structures that will support them during a grid down scenario. Now, I've done some investigations into tents and alternative domicile systems, and I've come to a couple of conclusions. The least difficult, or let's say the most affordable and simplest portable system, is actually a canvas tent. Not these cheap camping tents that are designed to be very lightweight and they use polyester materials, because those don't breathe. And so you can have a lot of humidity build up inside. But a canvas tent is actually built more like the old style homes, where air can move where desired, through the walls of the tent, and humidity is not going to get trapped inside. So if you're looking for a backup emergency shelter, seriously look into canvas tents. Now, I actually went out and bought three canvas tents. One was made in Australia, and it took a while to get that tent, and I forgot what that was called. Forgot the name of that, but I haven't yet set that one up. I bought another tent that was made in America, and then there's a third tent that's also made in America using a non-rip stop canvas material, so it could rip quite easily. From what I can tell, this Australian canvas tent, at least at first, seemed to be the most rugged, although I haven't tried it out yet. The thing is, canvas tents are very difficult to get. But in my research, I realized that probably the best setup for most people is a truck camper canvas tent. So if you have a pickup truck, they make different kinds of canvas tents that will fit the different bed lengths, you know, short bed, long bed, medium bed, whatever. And you can actually sleep off the ground then on an inflatable mattress in the back of your truck in a canvas tent in an emergency. That's actually not a bad setup. And I've mentioned this before. My grandparents lived in a tent following the Great Depression. It was a tent city. It was part of a corporation. My grandfather actually worked. This is my grandfather Adams. He actually worked for some, I don't even know what company it was. I think it was out west. Maybe it was Colorado or somewhere. He worked for a corporation, and the corporation had provided large acreage for families to set up tents. And they lived in a tent for a couple of years while people were getting, you know, collecting money and trying to get on their own 2 feet and move into something better. And this was after the Great Depression, right? A lot of people were wiped out. I think this is coming back. I think tent living is going to become a very viable option for a lot of people based on what's coming. Not just the economic fallout, but also the unreliable power grid and what that means to live in a structure that's not designed for natural heating or cooling. Tents can serve a very important function. And by the way, there's no shame in living in a tent. You know, quality of life is something that I think, just as a side note, needs to be completely redefined in society. Quality of life to me means having a spiritual life and having good health. You know, quality of life means having compassion, knowing each day that when you wake up and you go to sleep, that you are a good person, that you are helping humanity, that you are doing what is right for this world. That's quality of life. It doesn't matter if you do that in a tent, in a shack, or in a mansion. Actually, a mansion is kind of offensive to me. Why do you need all these stairs? Really? You know, and rooms? It just seems wasteful, but that's just my opinion. I don't care. If people want to live in a fancy house, that's fine. But I don't need a fancy house. And frankly, you don't either, to have a meaningful life. And there's no shame living in a tent if it's part of your survival strategy, so that you can stay alive. You can stay active here on this planet, in this realm, in this era, doing what God wants you to do in this world, whatever that is for you. God has a plan for you, and a lot of you have already figured out what that plan is, so pursue that plan. Doesn't matter if you sleep under the stars or sleep under a $1 million roof, you know? It's still the plan. Pursue it. That's what matters. Remember, you can't take a house with you anyway. Oh, by the way, also worth mentioning, because I've interviewed people who live in sort of caves in the Ozarks. And a cave is actually the smartest thing. It's got natural cooling. You know, temperature is the same pretty much all year round. It's a natural fallout shelter, you know, in case Russia launches nukes or the deep state launches nukes. You know, if you're lucky enough to be able to live in a cave or like a cutout hillside or even like an earth sheltered type of home, or a home made out of adobe or what's called tapia or straw bale homes or anything like that. Really like old style construction, but especially a cave. If you can live in a cave, that's ideal. You've solved so many problems right there, and you can live off grid. It's also quite secure. Hard for people to raid your cave because there's probably only one way in. So you can probably defend that pretty well. And depending on how deep your cave goes, you know, if you're lucky enough to have a cave, you could have a lot of supplies in there, as the government does. They've got caves. You know, I mentioned this, there are limestone caves in Kansas City that are deep, and I think you can even lease them out for corporate storage. So if anybody out there is thinking that I'm making this up about, you know, caves, No, there's caves all over, and there's tunnels, and there's deep underground military bases and all this stuff. And there's a reason why they go underground, because it's very survivable if chaos and, you know, bad things are happening on the surface of the planet. So think about that. Now, I want to circle back around to food acquisition here as another chapter of this little podcast. Food acquisition is going to become very difficult during any kind of effective cyber attack because, of course, food at retail requires electronic transactions for you to be able to get it. So let's say, you know, you're going in the grocery store, the grid goes down, and then you can't check out. Nobody can check out. Okay. But you want the food. You know, you got your truck in the parking lot. You've got gas or diesel. You've got transportation. You want the food. So, what could you offer maybe the store manager or maybe a cashier, but probably the store manager? What could you offer the store manager in order to buy that food? Maybe cash. Maybe just keep it simple. Hey, store manager, here's $300 in cash for, I don't know, $200 worth of food. Will you take the cash? I need this food. And see what they say. You could also, I mean, you'd have to interpret if this is appropriate for where you are or, you know, how much risk you want to take, but you could also maybe put $300 in an envelope, hand it to the manager, say, you know, this is, I'm buying this food. Here it is. Here's the date. Here's the estimated food amount of $200. I've paid you 50% extra. Here's the envelope. I'm leaving. Good luck. Probably he's going to be too busy to call the police anyway. And you might be the only one offering to pay for the food. Like everybody else is probably just looting the place. You offer to pay for the food. You're doing the moral thing. You know, you're not ripping off the food. You're paying extra, but you're also not getting held up and stuck without the food. So that's another thing to consider. Just see if it's right for you and your circumstances. Also, what if you had silver coins? What if you had a stash of silver coins in your vehicle? And the store manager was saying, gosh, you know, all our cashiers, stations are down, you know, credit cards are down. It's all down. And you say, hey, Mr. Store Manager, how about this? I've got, you know, 20 silver coins, 1 ounce coins from the U.S. Mint. Would you take these? And, you know, what's that worth? Right? About $500 or something more? Yeah, worth more than that. $600, let's say. You know, would you take these coins? Maybe you've overpaid at that point. I don't know. But it's possible that the store manager would accept those coins. And even if he doesn't, I think it's a good idea to have these backup plans. You know, how hard is it to carry some extra silver coins or some extra cash or some kind of barter item in your truck or in your car? Not that difficult. You just got to plan ahead. Put it in your bug out bag. You're going to find situations where you can probably apply these strategies to get what you need. Now, of course, the better plan overall is to already have this food, right? So stockpiling some food that could get you through difficult times, that makes a lot of sense. But there are probably things that you still need. You didn't get enough butter, maybe, or sugar, whatever you're into. Ice cream, you know, good luck with that since the freezer is going to melt. I can see half of America is like, I got to eat all this ice cream in 4 hours. You want to help? I need a bigger spoon because it's all going to melt. Like, so just giving themselves diabetes by the scoop. too bad for the power grid outage. It's like, how did you get so fat? Actually, well, the power grid went down and I had to eat everything in sight. That's what happened. Sorry to say, it wasn't my fault. I was just trying to not waste resources. You can hear the stories already. So in any case, as you can see, you're going to have to be rather adaptable and have multiple layers of backup plans for all kinds of systems of barter or transaction or, you know, purchasing or what have you. And my overall message on prepping, especially for cyber attacks and grid down scenarios, my overall message is don't rely too much on high-tech prepping. You know, it's very easy for preppers to fall into this habit of getting a lot of gadgets. You know, like, ooh, I have this really high-tech, awesome security system. Oh, I've got this drone, you know, it flies around the perimeter. And then I can watch what it sees on my iPhone. and you think you're prepping for this security system, but actually it all goes down. You know, your phone doesn't connect to your drone when the cloud is down. Your drone doesn't fly. So what if, instead of having a drone, what if you had a German Shepherd, you know? The German Shepherd doesn't need to talk to the cloud. German Shepherd's just like, enemy, I'm gonna bite his ass, you know? That has worked for centuries. Actually for millennia, come to think of it. That's worked for a long time. Without Amazon, AWS, and the internet and everything else. So think low tech. And this is a message I've been emphasizing for quite a long time. You know, I'm working on a book. I'm sorry to keep teasing this. It's called Resilient Prepping. It's going to be free. I'm just not finished with it yet because I got sidelined with stuff. Now I'm wondering if the book's ever going to come out before the entire internet goes down. But probably by the time I finish the book, no one can access it because the grid's down. It's like, number one lesson in resilient prepping, release the book before the grid goes down, right? That should be my reminder. But nevertheless, the overall strategy is the same. Think about low tech. This is why I'm a big fan of these non-circulating suspended net pot hydroponic grow systems that you hear me raving about all the time. And there's not even anything to buy on those, really. And we don't even have, we're not selling them. It's just watch the videos, learn how to make them yourself, and you can grow food for pennies. And I'm growing food constantly now in these systems. Constantly. I'm blending up entire salads in my smoothie now each day. I mean, like a big fistful of red oak leaf lettuce and Paris lettuce and kale and Swiss chard and some whatever else I've got. I'm throwing it in the blender. So I'm drinking salads. And that stuff can keep you alive. That's protein. That's plant minerals. That's magnesium. That's calcium in plant form. You wonder how you're going to survive. I mean, sure. Yeah. Maybe you need some meat and some animal fat and so on at some point, but you also need a lot of plant-based nutrients and you can create those essentially out of air using hydroponic systems. That should be a part of your low-tech prepping. And when I say hydroponic, I mean no pumps, no electricity, no circulation. That's super low-tech. I'm a big fan of super low-tech. Like if I could wear a sundial on my wrist that worked, I would. But obviously, sundial needs to be in one position and not move for it to work. People just think, what are you wearing a spike on your wrist? It's not a spike. It's a sundial. I just have to stand in the right place at the right angle. I'm like, dude, that is super low tech. You're like going back to the Egyptian era. Are you like a wannabe time traveler or something? Do you just love having no technology? No. Sundials worked for centuries. They were fine. And it's a great conversation piece too. Everybody asks, what is that? It's more interesting than walking around with a puppy. Okay, moving on. So in conclusion, the best way to think about this is to, again, audit your life, observe yourself as you move throughout the day, when you do things that are necessary for sustenance, when you acquire food or make food, you know, prepare food, or when you drink water, where does it come from? Or when you use a toilet, how does that work? You know, where does the water come from to flush the toilet? Or whatever you're doing in your life, what are the dependencies on the grid, on the banking system, on the financial transaction infrastructure, or on telecommunications, or on the water supply, for that matter? And when you take a good, honest look and you audit your life and all the dependencies, you'll realize that if you live in a city, you're living in a death trap. And that's why I've used that term for years. You're living in a death trap. Cities are not survivable in a grid down or even a banking system collapse scenario. They're not survivable by most people. The only way to survive would be to exit the city. And exiting is an adventure, like a choose your own ending adventure, but also while dodging gunfire or gangs or looters or whatever. Good luck with that, you know. You're not Kurt Russell, Snake Plissken. Probably not. So that might be a challenge to get out of the city, especially when the highways are all jammed up and you're trying to get out on a road. And that didn't work too well for the people of Ukraine. They all decided to leave Kiev and it's like, well, highways are all jammed up. Nobody can move anywhere. So can you get out on foot? Most people don't know where to go. Why? because they depend on GPS for all their navigation. Again, another problem depending on the cloud. You know, you should have topography maps, compass, understand where the sun is in the sky and what that means. Different times of the year. Why is the sun lower in the sky during the winter? What's going on? You know, why is the moon coming up on that side instead of the other side? Like, understand where you are in the cosmos, you know, and then you can probably navigate. You might be able to, you know, walk out of a city, and you want to walk out, by the way, at night. I think most survivalists would agree with that. You don't want to be walking around in the daytime when you're easy to spot. And then if you're maneuvering at night, you need to have light discipline and don't start a giant bonfire, you know, that everybody can see for miles around, and so on and so forth. So you get into the whole survival theme and you realize there's a lot to pay attention to, a lot to learn. But the simplest answer is don't live in the city. So if it all goes down, you don't have to bug out because you're already out. And that's why I have advocated that for a long time. So think about where you are and whether that's survivable in a grid down collapse or a, you know, an economic collapse, and adjust as well as you can. And I know that the listeners here to this podcast are way ahead of the curve of everybody else. And yet all of us share the common theme that we don't feel like we're ready enough, right? We all have that. Even I do, as a super prepper, so to speak. I still don't feel like I'm fully ready. We're never fully ready. It's okay. We're more ready than most, and we have the knowledge to be able to work with what we have, even if it's not perfect. And that's the mindset that will get you through all of this. So cyber attacks are probably coming. That's my conclusion. Definitely download my free book, survivalnutrition.com. Give that a listen. You know, review this podcast, share it with people that you think it might be able to help, and be ready to live in a low-tech scenario for some extended period of time, which means no fuel, no electricity, no money, no city water, all these things, no 911 services, no cell phone service, and so on and so forth. It's going to be interesting if that happens. I would not want to be in any blue city in America, which are already, you know, lawless and chaotic even on a good day. Imagine what happens in the middle of a collapse in one of those cities. You don't want to be anywhere near that. You can't even have enough ammo for that kind of scenario just for self-defense, right? You can't even carry enough ammo. So just don't be there is the best part of that answer, really. Okay, so that's a wrap. Again, check out our sponsor today, energizedhealth.com, for their coaching and life transformation cellular hydration course / program that I'm also joining, and I'll keep you posted on how that goes. See if I can make it through the 100 days. They were asking me if I was willing to commit to 100 days, and I'm like, man, I commit. I'm totally committed to health. I'm the health ranger. So just, yeah, I'm all in. Let's learn this stuff, right? So they haven't told me what it all involves yet. So I don't know. 900 sit-ups every morning. You know, I'm like, what? I don't know if I'm going to get a drill sergeant coach or a nice person that's like, do whatever you'd like to do. It's up to you. I'm like, well, then how about no sit-ups? No, we'll see. I'm just joking. We'll see how it goes. But also, if you want to get prepped and you want some storable food, obviously, healthrangerstore.com. I thank you for your support. And be sure to check out my coverage of all this at naturalnews.com and also brighteon.com. Thank you for listening today. God bless you. Sending you prayers for your safety and your preparedness and your calm courage during these very difficult times. You're ahead of the curve, folks. So there's nothing to panic about. Just get prepared and you'll make it through. We all will. We'll make it through. Okay. Thanks for listening. We'll talk to you tomorrow.